Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. You'll find us on the internet at salvationbygrace.org. We are currently studying the minor prophets of the Old Testament. So grab your Bible and join the congregation of GCA, along with our teaching pastor, Jim McClarty.
We're in Hosea 12 tonight. Hosea 12 is going to demonstrate a couple of very interesting aspects of God. Oftentimes, when people think about the characteristics and the power and the sovereignty of God, one of the examples that they will use, that I have often used, is that he can prophesy the future accurately, not because he knows the future, but because he declares the future, and then the future turns out exactly like he declared it was going to be. But God also has intimate knowledge of the past, and he can not only tell you what the past is, but he can tell you why. And I find that aspect even more impressive. God demonstrates it. God even brings it up and says that he's the God that can tell you what has happened and why it happened. And we're going to see a little bit of that tonight. This rebellion on the part of Ephraim and Judah is not unexpected to God. He knew that it was coming. I think we demonstrated that weeks ago when we looked at what I've called the blueprint. He said in advance what they were going to do. And now that they're doing it, chapter 12, he's going to look back at how they began. And he's going to demonstrate to them that they started out in the most humble of means, in the most humble of ways, and that they certainly have nothing to boast about. And that despite the fact that they were not a great people, that they exist only because he determined that they would exist, despite that fact, he wants to demonstrate that he was the one who brought them through all of the events of their history to bring them to the current state they're at. The very fact that they were once upon a time a major trading component in the Middle East, the very fact that they did once have King Solomon, all of that was a result of God determining that that is what was going to happen to them. And so you would think, at least from God's perspective, that after doing all that for them, they would be loyal to him. They would know their own history. They would recognize what God had done for them and remain loyal to him. But of course, as we've seen through the last several chapters, their lack of loyalty is something that he points out repeatedly. The second thing that he's going to do in chapter 12 is that he's going to remind them of covenants that he has made with them, that even though he is punishing them, he has still made continual promises to them. And he's going to demonstrate his own faithfulness, his own loyalty to his promises, like we talked about last week. And the third thing that I don't want us to miss from chapter 12 is that God keeps going back to his own word. The things that he has already said, he keeps pointing back at them. And I think that's the same as Christ when he was here on the planet, constantly pointing back to the word of God. And saying, like to the Pharisees, have you never read what God said to you? And then he quotes from the Old Testament scripture. So from God's perspective, from Christ's perspective, the word of God, the Bible, is God speaking. And because it's God speaking, the things that he declares in it are the things that he is going to do because he's faithful to himself and he's faithful to his own word. Okay, that's all the introduction. You're going to see those things come out as we read through this chapter, but we are also going to be spending a good deal of time tonight in the book of Genesis. So we're going to be flipping back and forth just a little bit because I'm not going to assume that you know these historic events. that are going to be mentioned here by God in Hosea 12. Hosea 12, verse 1, God talks about the futility of Ephraim and the fact that they have made bargains. They have made deals with Assyria and with Egypt. But those agreements, those covenants, those bargains are not going to keep them safe from the wrath of God. Because once God is determined to do something, it doesn't matter what human beings think. He's still going to do exactly what he said he's going to do. And so we've seen this before, this idea of sowing and reaping wind, that they sow to the wind and they reap a whirlwind. And when we came across it previously, I pointed out that it was God's way of saying, your plans are just futility. It's like trying to go out and accomplish mastery over the wind. You don't have any ability to make a deal with the wind. The wind is under God's sovereign control. And that's how chapter 12 starts. Verse 1, Ephraim feeds on wind. That's all they're consuming, is the nothingness that this world produces. And it pursues the east wind continually. And yet, despite the fact that they're making these deals, these bargains, despite the fact that they're forming these covenants and trying to make these trade deals with Assyria and with Egypt, God says it's as futile as making a deal with the wind. It's just empty. It's just completely vain. And by making those agreements, they are just multiplying their own lies. Because rather than trusting Yahweh to deliver them through all of these things, they nevertheless are trying to do it by their own power or by their own might or by the power and might of other nations. And God previously has referred to that as lying. And here he says, he, Ephraim, multiplies lies and violence. Moreover, he makes a covenant, an agreement with Assyria. And oil, probably olive oil, which was a major trading commodity at that point, oil is carried away to Egypt. So here is God once again pointing out that he knows exactly what it is they're doing. They're trusting in man's authority, man's power, man's armies. They're making deals with Assyria. They're making deals with Egypt that are ultimately going to prove to be completely futile because they are indeed going to go into the Assyrian captivity, where they will remain in a scattered state to this very day. And no amount of bargaining or agreeing or covenants changes that. So we can see the evidence that verse 1 is completely true. We know that Ephraim made those deals. We also know that God did exactly what he said he was going to do. Verse 2, the Lord, Yahweh, also has a dispute with Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. Now we need to talk about language for just a moment. Ephraim is a reference to the northern tribes. The northern tribes are sometimes called Mount Ephraim. Sometimes those northern 10 tribes are referred to as Israel, as contrasted with Judah. The first verse is talking particularly about those northern tribes. The second verse, God says that he also has a dispute with Judah, which we know he's going to carry Judah into the Babylonish captivity. But that's only going to be for 70 years because they do have to be back in their land in order for the Messiah to come through the tribe of Judah. That is a reference to the southern tribes as opposed to the northern tribes. But then when he says, I will punish Jacob for his ways, that's all 12. That's collectively the group. And so he says, I will punish Jacob. In a minute, we're going to get into some of the history of Jacob. Do you know what the name Jacob means? I find it very, very interesting that when God is talking about Israel, whom he loves, he calls them Israel collectively. But when he wants to point out their faults to them, they're Jacob, which means heel catcher, means supplanter. And we're going to see God point out that very thing. Yahweh also has a dispute with Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways and will repay him according to his deeds. And that's what the main thrust of the second half of the book has been so far, is God laying out his case and saying, I have this against Ephraim and against Judah. All of Jacob is guilty, and I will punish them because of their deeds. And then he reaches back into the history of Jacob in particular, and he says, in the womb, he took his brother by the heel, which is why he's referred to as the heel catcher, and in his maturity, he contended with God. Those are two major events from the life of Jacob that I think are worth going back and looking at this evening. So if you would, keep your finger there in Hosea and turn back to Genesis 25 first. Genesis 25, and we're going to start reading at verse 19. Genesis 25, 19. Now these are the records of the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel the Aramean of Padam Aram, the sister of Laban the Aramean, to be his wife. Now we need to take a moment and talk about who the Arameans are, because they're going to show up regularly. Not only did Isaac take a wife, Rebekah, from the Arameans, but his children also. Jacob himself is going to go have an Aramean wife, two to be exact. According to Genesis 10, there is a listing that we sometimes call the Table of the Nations that actually traces the descendants of Noah's three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And their subsequent dispersal across the earth after the great flood. And Aram was a descendant of Noah's son, Shem, which makes the Arameans part of the same lineage as the Hebrews. By the way, that name Shem is where we get the word Semites. To this very day, when you hear anti-Semitism, that's coming directly from anti-Shemites. The Arameans were Semitic people who spoke Aramaic. Their homeland was the large region of Aram, which is generally considered these days to be part of central Syria. And the Bible highlights that there were these family connections between the Jews and the Arameans, such as Abraham's servant going to Aram to find a wife for Isaac, who ended up marrying Rebekah, just like we just read. And then later, Jacob himself is going to marry Aramean women, Rachel and Leah. So back to Genesis chapter 25, verse 20. And Isaac was 40 years old, and he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban the Aramean, to be his wife. Isaac prayed to Yahweh on behalf of his wife because she was barren, and the Lord answered him, and Rebekah his wife conceived, but the children struggled together within her. And she said, if it is so, why then am I this way? And she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two people will be separated from your body. Two people groups, two nations of people. And the one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red all over, like a hairy garment, and so they named him Esau, which does mean red. And afterwards his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob, which means heel catcher. And Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. And the boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a peaceful man living in tents. And then the next several chapters of Genesis talk about the conflict that happened between Jacob and Esau. And of course, you probably are very aware of God's statement, "Jacob have I loved and Esau have I hated," which is more than just a statement of the nations that grew out of those two. But also, Paul picks it up in the book of Romans in order to demonstrate God's electing grace, that there were two babies in a womb who hadn't done any good or any evil, and yet God could say, "I love this one and I hate that one." So this is a really significant event that's happening here, and yet God takes the time to point out to Jacob, you were a heel catcher from the beginning. You were a supplanter from the beginning. And yet, despite that, I made covenants with you. I made promises to you. Stay there in the book of Genesis, and I'm just going to read from Hosea for just a second. Hosea 12, starting again in verse 3. "In the womb, he took his brother by the heel, and then when he grew up in his maturity, he contended with God." And that is the place where God changed his name and gave him the name Israel. So go to Genesis 32 for a second, and we're going to start reading in verse 9. Genesis 32, starting at verse 9. "Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Yahweh, who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you,' I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and of all the faithfulness which you have shown to your servant. For with my staff only I crossed this Jordan," going into the area of the Arameans, "and now I have become two companies of people. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him that he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children." Now, why would he fear him? Because he had tricked him out of his birthright blessing. Because Esau was the first one born, he was supposed to be getting the birthright blessing. But while Esau was out in the field, out trying to catch venison to please his father, Jacob and his mom conspired to make a plan where he would wear his brother's clothing. They put a little bit of hair on the back of his hands to make him smell and feel like his brother. His father's eyes were failing him, and he did indeed give the birthright blessing to Jacob, thinking he was giving it to Esau. When Esau came back, he was surprised to find out that he had been cheated out of his birthright blessing. Which is exactly what God said when they were both born, that the older was going to serve the younger, which was completely backward the way things were normally done there in the Middle East. The older got the birthright and the younger would serve the older. But God turned everything upside down, as he so frequently does, and said that the older would serve the younger. So now that he's going back to his own land, he's afraid because he believes that his brother is going to attack him and the mothers and the children. And then in verse 12, he reminds God that this was God's idea. "For you said, 'I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be numbered.' And he spent the night there. And then he selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau, 200 female goats and 20 male goats and 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. And he delivered them into the hand of his servants. Everyone drove by itself. And he said to his servants, 'Pass on before me and put a space between each of these droves.' And he commanded the one in the front, saying, 'When my brother Esau meets you and asks you, saying, "To whom do these belong and where are you going and to whom do these animals in front of you belong?" Then you will say, 'These belong to my servant Jacob,' or 'These belong to your servant Jacob.' It is a present to my lord Esau. And behold, he also is behind us. And then he commanded also that the second and the third and all those that followed with the droves would say, after this manner, you shall speak to Esau when you find him. And you shall say, behold, your servant Jacob also is behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me. And then afterward, I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. So the present passed on before him while he himself spent the night in the camp. And he arose that same night and he took his two wives and his two maids and his 11 children and crossed the ford of Jabbok and took them and sent them across the stream and he sent across whatever he had. And then Jacob was left alone and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. And when he saw that he could not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his thigh. In other words, the angel of the Lord touched the socket of Jacob's thigh, which would have changed his walk from there forward. And so the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. And then he said, let me go, for the dawn is breaking. The angel apparently said that. But he, Jacob, said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Jacob recognized that the angel was the greater, because the greater always blesses the lesser. So we said to him, what is your name? And he had to admit, heel catcher. Jacob, supplanter. I know it's not a great name. That's my name. And the angel said, your name shall no longer be Jacob, Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. And then Jacob asked him and said, please tell me your name. And he said, why is it that you ask my name? And he blessed him there. So Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been preserved. And now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Penuel, and he was limping on his thigh. And therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh and the sinew of his hip. That was all included in verse 3 of Hosea 12. Those two major events God looked back at and said, number one, when you were born, you were a supplanter. But number two, you wrestled with the angel of God and your name was changed to Israel. He wanted Jacob to remember this. He wanted national Jacob to remember this. That from the very beginning, they were evil people. From the very beginning, they carried the name of their father, Jacob. And the only reason that they were called Prince Who Has Power With God, or the only reason they were called the One Who Contends With God, is because God himself came to Jacob. Jacob didn't come to God. God came to Jacob and changed his name and then changed his walk. Now turn over to Genesis 28 for a moment, and then we'll go forward again. Genesis 28, we're going to start reading at verse 10, because this is an important little detail. This is, of course, Jacob's dream. Jacob departed from Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he came to a certain place, and he spent the night there because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of the place, and he put it under his head, and he laid down in that place. And he had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, Yahweh stood above it and said, I am Yahweh, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and your descendants. There's God taking that Abrahamic covenant and that promise of land that was made to Abraham and then passing it down to Isaac and now passing it down to Jacob. Your descendants will also be like the dust of the earth. And you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. You can look at the condition of the Jews in the world right now and you'd have to say, well, that happened. That's true. They're scattered all over the place. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. That's the promise he made to Abraham originally. And now he has passed that promise down to Jacob. Behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land. So here is God promising this covenant, reminding Jacob, reminding Israel of this covenant, that though they're being driven out of their land as he is punishing them, they still have the covenant promise given to Abraham, given to Isaac, given to Jacob, that God is going to give them that land ultimately because it is a continual promise. Behold, I am with you, and I will bring you. By the way, this is after you spread out to the west and the east and the north and the south. I will keep you wherever I scatter you, and I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I promised you. And Jacob awoke from his sleep, and he said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid. And he said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So Jacob rose up early in the morning, and he took the stone that he had put under his head, and he set it up as a pillar, and he poured oil over its top, and he called the name of that place Bethel. However, previously, the name of the city had been Luz. Then Jacob vowed a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food to eat and garment to wear and I return to my father's house safely, then Yahweh will be my God. This stone which I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you. Okay, one more passage. I just want to read all these Genesis passages so that we're familiar with them. When we get back to Hosea, turn to Genesis 35. These are all the major events of Jacob's life. And we're going to read the first 15 verses here. Genesis 35, starting at verse 1, then God said to Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel. Now we know where that name came from. It's the very place that God met him and showed him the ladder with the angels of God ascending and descending. He named that place Bethel. By the way, what we've seen so far in the book of Hosea, just so you don't miss it, they set up a golden calf to worship at Bethel. And God started referring to it instead of the house of God as the house of iniquity, the house of transgression. God said to Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel and live there and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau. That's what we just read. So Jacob said to his household and to all that were with him, put away your foreign gods which are among you, and purify yourselves and change your garments, and let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to Elohim, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me wherever I have gone. You'll notice that when he made the deal at Bethel that we just read in Genesis 28, he was asking God to be with him the whole time. Here he is saying, he was with me in my day of distress, and he was with me the whole time. So they gave to Jacob all the foreign gods which they had and the rings that were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the oak which was near Shechem, and they journeyed, and there was a great terror upon the cities which were around them. And they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. In other words, as Jacob and his people were moving through the area, the cities would have descended on them, being strangers. But God also put apparently some kind of plague, some kind of terror on the cities, so that they didn't have time to go out and fight with anybody else, which actually gave Jacob safe passage. So God, in his sovereignty, in keeping his promise to Jacob, also made other people uncomfortable and brought terrors on them in order to keep Jacob safe. That's not only sovereign election, but that is a demonstration that God can move heaven and earth in order to accomplish his will for his own people. Just didn't want you to miss that. As they journeyed, there was a great terror upon the cities which were around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. So Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, he and all his people who were with him. And he built an altar there and called the place El Bethel, because there God had revealed himself to him when he fled from his brother. Now Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died and was buried below Bethel under the oak, and it was named Alon Bakuth. Then God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Padam Aram, and he blessed him again. Remember, when his name was changed to Jacob, he insisted on receiving a blessing. How many times now has God continued to bless him? And the blessing is the recitation again of his name change and the promise of the Abrahamic covenant. Your name is Jacob. You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name. Thus he called him Israel, and God said to him, I am God Almighty. I am Elohim, all-powerful. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall come forth from you. And the land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac I will give to you. And I will give the land to your descendants after you. Very important detail. Then God went up from him in the place where he had spoken with him. And Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he had spoken with him, a pillar of stone. And he poured out a drink offering on it. And he also poured oil on it. So Jacob named the place where God had spoken to him, Bethel, and they journeyed from Bethel. And when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath, Rachel began to give birth, and she suffered severe labor. Okay, that should bring us kind of up to date with what we're reading in Hosea. I hope you at least absorbed those large stories, because now God is going to make reference to those stories in order to show that Israel started out as being so very poor, and yet they became this great company of people because God determined it from the beginning. He had even told Rebekah, there are two nations in your womb that are contending against each other. God knew the people groups that were going to grow out of Jacob and Esau. And Jacob became the Israelites, and Esau became the Esauites, who became the Arameans, who we know today as the Arabs. So I contend yet again what I've contended so many times through the years: you can't understand world geopolitics if you don't understand your Bible. That's where all these people groups come from. But remember again that Israel and the Arabs, the Arameans or the Esauites, they're common people. They have a common heritage. They have a common fatherhood, which is why there was also intermarriage between them. I'm back in Hosea 12. You've probably been there the whole time. Verse 3, in the womb, Jacob took his brother by the heel, and then in his maturity, he contended with God. Yes, he wrestled with the angel and prevailed. He wept, and he sought the angel's favor, and he found him at Bethel, and there He spoke with us. Really interesting language. As Jacob was speaking to the angel, God pluralizes it and says he spoke with us, the Elohim, even Yahweh, the God, the Elohim of armies. And Yahweh is his name. Therefore, this is the therefore after all that, after all those reminders, therefore, Jacob, return to your God. I'm the one that did all this for you. I'm the one that gave you your land. I'm the one that made you powerful. I'm the one that made you influential. So return to your God. And that return would look like this. Observe kindness and justice. That word kindness can also be translated loyalty. Be loyal, look after justice, and wait for your God continually. That does not mean tap your toes, twiddle your thumbs, and wait until God does something. This is the same kind of waiting as if you go to a restaurant and there's a waiter who takes care of you. He's saying, serve your God, wait on your God continually. And if you're waiting on Yahweh continually, you don't have time to go chase after these foreign gods. Then he's going to describe Israel currently, and he says, a merchant in whose hands are false balances. He loves to oppress. And Ephraim said, surely I have become rich. I have found wealth for myself. And in all my labors, they will find in me no iniquity, which would be sin. So they're self-justifying. They're taking credit for the fact that God has given them wealth, power, influence. And as a consequence, they oppress the poor. If I can use this word or this phrase properly, they were guilty of social injustices. Because God said you're like a merchant who doesn't use a fair scale. You use false scales and false balances. And way back when we were teaching through the book of Proverbs, we saw how often Solomon would bring that up, that it was necessary when dealing with each other to be fair and not to use false scales to enrich yourself. And yet he says that's exactly what Jacob has become like. And then Ephraim takes credit for it. Surely I've become rich. I have found wealth for myself. And in all my labors, they will find in me no iniquity, which would be sin. But I have been Yahweh your God since the land of Egypt, and I will make you live in tents again. In other words, you were brought into Egypt through Joseph, through his brothers, and then you became, over the course of 400 years, a mighty nation. I delivered you through Moses, through my miraculous provision, and I brought you back to the very land that was promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. When I found you, you were slaves in Egypt. You were nothing. And then you became all this. And I'm the one who did it. I have been Yahweh your God since the land of Egypt. And I will make you live in tents again. I do think in this context what he's saying is when you were in Egypt, when you were nomadic people, when you didn't have a land, you had to live in tents. But then you were here and you had built houses, you had built permanent residence for yourself, but I'm going to drive you out of the land and I'm going to make you go back to dwelling in tents again. And then he compares it to as in the days of the appointed feast. And that would be the festival of booths, when they would have to build temporary dwellings that they would live in to remind themselves of those days when they didn't have a permanent land, when they were slaves. And so God is saying, I'm going to drive you into Assyria, and just like it was in Egypt, it's going to be for you yet again. And you are going to live in tents again. the same way that you do during the festival, during that Feast of Booths. Also, on top of all that, on top of everything else I've done for you, on top of finding you when you were a heel catcher, finding you when you were slaves, and making promises and covenants to you, and a land promise that I am determined to keep. And on top of all that, I sent you prophets. And he didn't send any other people prophets. There were no other people groups getting prophets. Not even the Arameans, not even close cousins. And God knows that he sent prophets continually to Israel, and that makes them all the more responsible. I have also spoken to the prophets, and I gave numerous visions. And through the prophets, I gave parables. Is there iniquity in Gilead? The answer is yes, because that was one of the places where they were worshiping. That was one of the high places where they were worshiping in their groves and up on the hills. And then he points out that the bulls, that the calves, that the idols are completely useless, proving yet again the iniquity, the fault of Ephraim for worshiping in Gilead. Is there iniquity in Gilead? Surely they are worthless. In Gilgal, they sacrifice bulls, which was one of the requirements that God required as a sin offering in his temple. And yet now they're taking those same bulls that God provided for them, and they're using them in the worship of their idols and their foreign gods. In Gilgal, they sacrifice bulls. Yes, their altars are like stone heaps beside the furrows of the field. That's God's way of saying, I'm going to wreck it all. I'm knocking it all down. All those altars that you built to all those gods, I will not let it stand. I'm going to destroy them all. I'm going to scatter them all. And then he goes back to remind them of their history again and to remind them of some of the things we've already read. Now, Jacob fled to the land of Aram. That's right, to get away from Esau. He went to Aram, and while he was there, he got a wife. While he was there, he had his first children via four different women. And then he came back a great company of people when God told him to return to his own land. But he did flee to Aram, and Israel worked for a wife. By the way, you probably know that story. Jacob loved Rachel. And so he agreed to work for Laban for 7 years in order to get Rachel for a wife. And after 7 years, he went in the tent on his wedding night. He woke up in the morning and ta-da, it's Leah. Leah was the older sister, and Laban didn't think it was right that the younger get married before the older. There we see that principle at work again. And so Jacob worked another 7 years. 14 years he worked altogether for Laban just to get Rachel his beloved. And of course, Rachel was the one who had trouble getting pregnant. While Leah and her handmaid and Rachel's handmaid all produced, and then ultimately Rachel gave birth to Benjamin and Joseph, and so they became the most beloved of Jacob's children. God knows all that. I just recited all that quickly. God knows all that, points it out, and explains the why of it. And by the way, he's also referring to his own word and saying that's accurate history. Now, if God himself says that his word, the Bible, is accurate history, that's good by me, because earlier in that same book of Genesis, there's stuff like the flood, which Jesus validated and said was real history. And there's stuff like the seven-day creation and Adam and Eve, which Jesus said was valid history. If you're going to say that because of God speaking through Hosea, all of that stuff about Jacob is accurate history, you only have to go back a few chapters to get into that more controversial stuff. But if God and Jesus both validate that the early Genesis stuff is accurate history and the very word of God, then who are you to fight with God? I didn't mean to look right at you when I said, who are you? But who are you really to fight with that God and say, no, it's not? You're not big enough to pull that off. He's the God who's in charge of history, and he validates the history of the book of Genesis. Okay, I've got to finish up here. Israel worked for a wife, and for a wife he kept sheep. But by a prophet, Yahweh brought Israel from Egypt, that'd be Moses, and by a prophet, Israel was kept. Ephraim has provoked to bitter anger. So his Lord will leave his blood guilt on him and bring back his reproach to him. Next week, we'll pick up at when Ephraim spoke, there was trembling, and he exalted himself in Israel, but through Baal, he did wrong and died. That's the perfect synopsis of the history of Israel. They originally were just sons of Jacob. Jacob himself, heel catcher, came out of the womb being a supplanter and a trickster who actually got the birthright through trickery. And that's just his nature. That's his character. So then no surprise that all of his children would be children who like unjust weights and who like to take credit for what they've accomplished. God is pointing out, you're just like your dad. You're just like your forefather. But I changed your forefather's name to Israel, and I made covenants with him, and I made promises to him that include you, that include you getting the land. And you're going to actually end up back where I said you were going to go, but I'm going to punish you and I'm going to send you into captivity for the moment. So we see here both the severity of God, we see the faithfulness of God in keeping his own word and sticking to his blueprint, but we also see the continuity of God and the faithfulness of God in that while he's telling Israel how bad their guilt is, and how far he has brought them from their beginnings, and how they were just slaves, and how they were children of Arameans, demonstrating that his covenants that he has made to them and his faithfulness to his covenants overrides everything they are in order to show the glory of who he is. And that's the same God we're talking about today. It's the same God we worship today. It's the same God who can look at any of you and go, yeah, you know, you're a genuine disappointment. I mean, straight down the line. But I'm God. And I specialize in saving sinners. And so, whether we're looking at Hosea, whether we're looking at Genesis, or whether we're looking at Christ in the New Testament, the story is the same. The story of redemption and salvation always redounds to the glory of God, and men can never lift themselves up. Men can never brag that they're the ones who accomplished it. He even points out Ephraim attempted to do that, but that's why he had to take the time to say, yeah, but who are you really? And I think that's a question we can all consider about ourselves. We're all some well-dressed, pretty good-looking people in here tonight.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, you're welcome. But why is that? It's because God has been good to you and not because you deserved it, but because he is faithful to his word, he's faithful to his promises, he's faithful to Christ, and therefore you are the recipients of this astounding, faithful grace of God. It is all, again, redounding to the glory of God, and never, never, never to your glory. You got it?
Mm-hmm.
Good chapter, huh?
Yes.
Yeah. Because it's the chapter that said you were a bunch of good-looking people. So, yeah. So, hey, by the way, before I let you go, since I do have it here in my notes, the very end of that chapter, at least verse 12, Hosea reminded the people, as I kept saying, about their humble beginnings. Their most famous ancestor was once a refugee who had to tend sheep in order to acquire a wife. That's what we just read. And later, Jacob's descendants served the Egyptians until God delivered them from Egypt and protected them through his prophet Moses. That's what we just read. But Deuteronomy 26:5 does actually say, "And you shall answer and say before Yahweh your God, my father was a wandering Aramean, and he went down to Egypt and sojourned there as few in number, but there he became a great and mighty and populous nation." So even the book of Deuteronomy recites the things that God is referring to here. And since I took the time to dig that out and put it in my notes, I thought I needed to toss that out at the end here. So.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace midweek message. We encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org for books, articles, and our ever-expanding archive of audio sermons. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.